Thank you everyone for being here, and thank the organizer for giving me the opportunity to present at this very nice conference. So the title of my talk is Simulating Two-Dimensional Lattice Gauge Theories on a QDIS Quantum Computer. And the talk is going to be based on this preprint that we recently put out on Archive. And this is an experimental collaboration between a theory Waterloo team and an experimental team at the University of Innsbruck, where they have an amazing trapped ion system. And we were able to, yeah, to use their trapped ion systems to do some pretty cool quantum computing. Yeah, so I will start with giving you a little bit of motivation and the background about why we think that this is interesting and why we think specifically quantum simulation of lattice gauge theory is a good, it's a potential good field where to find quantum advantage. Then I will try not to get too technical and I will flash some equations, but I will have to introduce the model that we simulated on their quantum computer, which is quantum electrodynamics in 2+1 dimensions. And then I will show you the two use cases, the two computations that we did. It was with two slightly different instances of the model, and each one of them highlights a different feature that this QDIT system have. And then I will conclude, there will be a summary and a quick outlook. So why do we need simulations in general? So in science, in physics, not only physics and in science, there are many fields where the fundamental laws are perfectly known, right? We could just write them on paper, and in theory, those equations contain everything we ever need to know. However, the cases in which we can actually do pen and paper computations are very are rare, there are not so many. And in those cases, we absolutely have to use numerical simulation of some kind. In particular, what I focus on, it's the case of the standard model for high energy physics. The standard model is completely formulated in terms of gauge theories. They have beautiful symmetries, very elegant theory. But yeah, they're just very hard to solve. And people have realized this since the beginning. And in fact, already the field of classical computations for quantum chromodynamics, which is a part of the standard model, this field is 50 years old, is extremely successful, and it developed also in parallel with the development of high-performance classical computing. I heard some really nice talks of physicists interested in doing computations in lattice QCD, rigging up their own parallel computing systems at a time where classical computers would take half a room, you know, and were very, very primitive to our eyes. The field of classical lattice computation has been extremely successful, is still very successful. The community is huge, and it also has produced some of the most precise computations that have been verified by experiments in nature. However, that is not the whole story, because this classical simulation method, they are based on the Lagrangian formalism, and they are essentially all based on what is called the Markov chain Monte Carlo method. And in the Markov chain Monte Carlo method, what you need to do is that you have to calculate a certain probability distributions to sample from, right? And the issue with that is that in certain physically interesting settings, these probability distributions that you want to calculate become numerically unstable. So, and this is really like a point of principle. These specific settings are really impossible to study for just classical method. And here you see some examples of these settings. One is real-time evolution. So classic Markov chain Monte Carlo cannot describe, for example, particle collisions, right? Another interesting case is the high baryon density. There are various settings where you can find it. Here it's an image of a neutron star. And then you have a sign problem also when you talk about topological terms, and topological terms are these terms that people add to the theory in order to try to explain the asymmetry of matter and that antimatter that we observe in nature. So as you can see, these are all very good questions that many people are interested in. And the classical computations cannot do anything about it. However, quantum computing is naturally formulated in terms of the Hamiltonian formalism. And the Hamiltonian formalism is intrinsically sign problem free. So there is nothing in principle that stops us from doing quantum simulation, quantum computation on these models. And this is just, the Hamiltonian formulation of this theory has been known for a long time, since the 70s. But it's really with the recent development of quantum technologies that a lot of interest has come up, right? Because now we really can try and do some of these quantum simulations. So this is generally what we try to do in the field of quantum simulation for particle physics. Here on the right, you see a sort of a very reduced timeline. The general idea of using quantum systems to simulate under quantum systems, of course, is old, is since Feynman's time, right? But the first concrete proposal came only in the 2012s. The first experiment was in 2016. And just to give you an idea of, this was really a proof of principle, just to give you an idea of how young the field is, in this paper, they used a trapped ion system to simulate QED, in that case as well, on a quantum computer, which was a trapped ion system, with only four sites, right? So we're really talking about like the proving that, like really this proof of principle type of experiment. But since then, really the interest has exploded, right? And the community has grown very big. There are now like dedicated workshops and conferences and funding systems. Here I'm just putting two white papers that try to summarize what is the current status, and I highly recommend both of them if you want to know what is the situation right now. So in the end, what we want to do is we want to use quantum computers to simulate nature. If you consider this case where we were considering a relatively simple gauge theory in a reduced space-time dimensions and on a very small size, you can see that we have a lot of space. There are a lot of directions which we have to go before we can claim to have simulated nature. Of course, we need to increase the number of dimensions that I'm simulating. In this case, they were simulating a U1 gauge theory. U1 is a very small part of the standard model, of course. So we want to simulate, ideally, QCD, quantum chromodynamics, so consider SU3 as the gauge group. And then, of course, there's the question of how to best utilize the quantum resource that we have available at any point in time, and which are the most suitable algorithms. So these are all very general questions. The field is very new, and as I said, there's lots of space to develop. And here, I'm putting just a few examples out of many, many more that you could find of experimental quantum computations that have been done for lattice gauge theories. So this is a paper that I mentioned before from 2016. What they looked at with their four-ion quantum computing was a pair creation phenomenon. So they did a real-time evolution, and they were able to see creation of electron-positron pair in their system. This is a more recent work, also with trapped ion system. You can see now we have many more ions available. And the people have also worked in the directions of considering different gauge groups. So for example, this paper considers a pure gauge theory, so there's no fermionic matter. And this paper considers a simplified Z2 pure gauge theory. If you can notice a common theme, usually in these experiments, people decide to go one of two ways. You have gauge fields and you have matter, right? If you want matter, you better choose a one-dimensional space, a one-dimensional system. And people do that because if you are in one spatial dimension and you have open boundary condition, then the gauge fields are not completely free degrees of freedom anymore, and they can be integrated. So that's an enormous simplification that comes. Or if you want to go to more spatial dimension, then you better not consider matter fields. which adds a lot of complication, and you simplify also the gauge group. So really, this was also a little bit to highlight that it is very challenging, and people have to, you know, make compromises about what they are able to simulate. And another notable thing is that in all of this experimental realization, people took their system and only used their system as qubits. These are all qubits type of simulation. So what do I want to do? As I said in my title, I want to simulate a two-dimensional quantum, a two-dimensional lattice gauge theory, and I want it to be complete with both gauge field and with matter. So in this case, I cannot eliminate the gauge field anymore, which means that I have to simulate it somehow, right? I have to put it somewhere on my quantum hardware. So this is the cost, and the advantage is as soon as I go to two spatial dimensions, then I have more interesting phenomena happening, namely I have magnetic fields that magnetic effect that appears. So you can see that that in this theory we naturally have multi-level systems because these gauge fields have these infinite dimensional systems that now I have to figure out how to simulate, right? And in other theories, so here it's a really nice recent paper, they consider a slightly different theory, but I just wanted to highlight that just to say that this is not the only place where multidimensional systems appear. But here they consider an SU2 gauge theory, and then they reformulate it in a very smart locally gauge invariant rest basis. And then in that case, the matter side become the naturally multidimensional system to be simulated. So this is what I want to do. What do I have on the other side? So in general, you can imagine that at a superficial level, if you instead of a two-level system, a qubit, you have a multidimensional system, qubit with d levels. This can, in general, make possibly the same experiments with smaller registers, with low-depth circuits. These are all both like really key important features, right? Because the quantum computers that we have available right now are really noisy. So the less, the shallower my circuit, the better is going to be the result. And what made this really possible is what made this work really possible is that the experimental team were able to realize some really high fidelity entangling gates. Like realizing this kind of entangling gates is really non-trivial, and it's a key advance that they were able to do. Yes. Any questions? Feel free also to interrupt me at any time, of course. Okay, so next, if there are no questions, next I'm going to get to be a little bit more specific and talk more about the model that I'm simulating. Yes. So as I said, what I'm considering is 2D QED, the quantum electrodynamics in two spatial dimensions, in the Hamiltonian formulation and then in the Kogosuskin Hamiltonian formulation, if you want the exact name. So in this case, I have a two-dimensional lattice. On the sides of my lattice, I have my fermionic fields. And then on the links of my lattice, it's where my gauge field lives. And the Hamiltonian is made of the following parts. I have first a sum of an electric and a magnetic term. These are terms these are the free energy of the gauge field, OK? Yes. And then this term is going to be the free energy of fermionic matter. So that is my mass Hamiltonian. So this term essentially tells me how much it costs me to add fermions to my system. And you can see that I'm using the stagger formulation where I'm putting matter and antimatter sites matter and antimatter fields on alternating sites. You don't need to care about the details, but I want to put in your mind that there are these different components of the Hamiltonian. And then finally, I have the kinetic term. And the kinetic term is what describes the interaction between the fermions at my site and the gauge field, right? And most importantly, this kinetic term has to be has to respect the gauge symmetry of my gauge theory and has to be gauge invariant. Yes, in the case of the Hamiltonian formulation, these terms are not enough to completely describe my theory, but I also need what is called the Gauss law. And if I say the name Gauss law, essentially it's the same, it's what you're thinking of. The Gauss law is a constraint that I have at every site that tells me that essentially the fields coming out of the site has to be equal to the fields coming in, plus the charge at the site. So it's really the classical the classical electrodynamics Gauss law that that you all know. So these equations completely determine the theory that I want, and these are the basic ingredients. I have fermionic matter sites and bosonic gauge fields. So now the next question is going to be, how do I map this field onto my quantum processor, right? So the easy thing are the matter fields, right? Because in this model that I'm considering, the matter fields are just fermionic fields. So I can map each one of them with an appropriate Jordan-Wigner transformation. I can map each fermionic field just to a qubit, a two-level qubit. The gauge field is where things get more interesting, because in quantum electrodynamics, the Hilbert space of the gauge field, if I write it in the what we call the electric basis, as I mentioned before, is this infinite dimensional Hilbert space. It's this infinite ladder. Physically, this means each one of these eigenstates is saying, oh, on this link, do I have zero electroflux? Or do I have a positive 1, plus 2, plus 3? Or could be pointing the other way, right? I could have a minus 1, minus 2, et cetera, electric flux at the site. And this is what I need to truncate, right? And the specific case that I will consider in the rest of the talk is going to be the cases where I consider these three central levels. So I will use a Q-treat to model my gauge field, or I will consider five of them. So I will use a Q-quint to model my gauge field. I will explain when and why I will make different choices. In slightly more technical term, this means, what it means in details means that I am approximating my gauge group, U1, with a discrete Z group with the odd number of elements. And then I will truncate, so this will discretize all of the eigenstate that I have, right? Like it's like closing this ladder into a circle. And then I will make some assumptions that the physics actually doesn't happen everywhere on this circle uniformly, but only happens around, like centers around some physical states that I'm interested in, which means that I will truncate to some smaller number, smaller odd number of states. So this is my recipe to map the ingredients that I told you about before onto my quantum processor. What kind of algorithm do I want to run? We are going to run what is called a variational quantum eigensolver. This is a hybrid quantum classical algorithm that finds the ground state of a Hamiltonian. How many of you are familiar with this? Some, but not all. Okay, so I will quickly explain it. So in this, this is called a variational quantum eigensolver. I have two processing units. I have one quantum processing unit, and I have a classical processing unit that are interacting. The goal of this algorithm is going to be to find the ground state of a specific target Hamiltonian, this H here. And the way you do it is that you use the quantum processor for what a classical computer would not be very good at doing. So, which is namely, you make your guess for what the ground state is, your guess is going to be a parameterized, is going to be essentially a variational circuit that prepares an unsat state, right? So the quantum circuit will prepare these ansatz, and it will measure the cost function. So because I want to find the ground state, the cost function that I want to minimize is going to be at expectation value of this my target Hamiltonian onto this ansatz state. And this cost function is sent to the classical computer, and the classical computer has just the role of an optimizer. So it takes in the cost function, it gives some new variational parameters for the quantum processor to try, and then this is just this is going to be iterated until hopefully it converges. When it converges, in principle, I have found the thetas, the variational parameters, that minimize my cost function. And therefore, I have found the theta in my circuit that will produce the ground state of this Hamiltonian. Yeah? And then I can measure whatever property I want onto the ground state of the ground state that I have found. Why did we choose to run specifically a variational quantum eigensolver? One thing is that due to its variational nature, it is a little bit more forgiving of certain types of error. And the other thing is that, in principle, you have a lot of flexibility in how you're designing this parameterized your variational circuit, right? So depending on the specific hardware that you have available, what kind of gates it is better at doing, it just gives you this flexibility where you can make a better match, right? You design your variational circuit in a way that is inspired by the solution that you want to find, but is also experimentally friendly, and it's not something crazy that you're asking the lab people to do. Okay. The algorithm I'm going to run is the variational quantum eigensolver. As I promised, I'm going to tell you about two specific applications. The first application is going to be a plaquette with open boundary conditions. So the system I'm considering has only four sites with open boundary condition. If you remember, at every site, I have the Gauss law that tells me that there has to be certain relationship between the fields adjacent to a site and the charge in the site. So in this case, I have three independent Gauss law. So it means that out of the four gauge fields that I had in the beginning, I can eliminate three of them. Only degrees of freedom I'm left are then these four fermionic degrees of freedom and one gauge field. Every other gauge field can be uniquely determined by the configuration of these ones, yeah? Okay, so this is I have the target model that I want to solve. Next, I'm going to design my variational circuit. So I will not get too much into the details of this, but I will happily, tell you more if you want to ask more specific question, but generally what we do is that we look at the target Hamiltonian that we want to solve. We look at what kind of symmetry it has, and what kind of interaction it has between what elements of the theory, and based on that we come up with we design our variational circuit. And then, here again you see the variational, the iteration loop. What do I do? I do this. I run my variational eigensolver with this specific variational circuit, and then in the end, on the ground state, I'm going to measure what we call the plaquette. So the plaquette is just going to be proportional to the magnetic field Hamiltonian. And the reason why we look at this specifically is because it is physically interesting, and it is related to the phenomenon of the running of the coupling that. The people in high energy physics study more in general. And here, just to explain a little bit why this circuit looks like this, right? I have my four fermionic degrees of freedom that I have mapped onto four different qubits, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then my gauge field is going to be modeled by a fifth ion. And with this fifth ion, I will use it as a Q-trit. So here, with the fanning out, I'm making explicit the three internal levels that I'm considering of this qubit, so that we could be like unambiguous about what kind of gates we were applying. I hope this is clear. So I want to, for just a moment, compare this variational circuit to this qubit-based variational circuit. So the idea that we used to design this circuit came from this previous work of our group. In that work, they talked about the symmetries and the reasoning behind the design of the variational circuit, and then they made a proposal that was purely based on qubit system, which you can see here. I hope you can recognize that it has just about the same structure, right? You still have the four qubits for the matter system. But now, if you see for the gauge field, they are using three qubit to model the three system. I mean, this is a choice that they made. This is called the one hot encoding, which means that if you want to model, in general, D systems, you're going to use D qubit. And then you have the constraint that out of all of the d qubits that you have, only one can be up. And then the position of which is up is going to tell you which level is populated, right? So this is a little bit of a inefficient in terms of the register size, right? Because for d level, you're going to use d qubits. But if you compare it to other qubit implementation, it saves you a little bit in terms of the number of entangling gates. So with qubits, you're always going to have this this balance. So you either want a very small register, but then you will have to use a lot of entangling gates, or you can have a large register, and you will need only fewer entangling gates. The structure of the circuit is the same, and we did some back of the envelope calculations to compare how these two different circuits would perform. So specifically, because the experimental system that I'm considering is calcium ions, they can go up to seven different. They can go up to Q sept. So I can use up to seven internal levels. And you can see that with the qubit encoding, no matter the dimension d that I'm using to truncate the gauge field, I will always just need only these five ions to model the system. So it's constant in the register size, while it is it's linear, right? If I'm considering the qubit encoding, but the biggest difference comes when you consider the number of entangling gates. So we sort of recompiled this in terms of C naught to have it to compare apples with apples. What comes out of this calculation is that the number of entangling gates that you need for this qubit-based system is much, much larger. And when it becomes so much larger, it means that when you're for a small error in every C naught is going to compound exponentially, right? So if I have this realistic fidelity of my gates, I can sort of get some signal out of a qubit encoding, but with a qubit, I lose almost everything, right? And if I have even more very optimistic estimate for my fidelity, then the qubit encoding tells me, the circuit can actually perform relatively well. But if you look at the qubit version, it's just going to be like noise. It's going to be a disaster. So they actually did it. They took the circuit, they ran an actual VQE, a variational quantum eigensolver, and these are the results. So as I said, the observable that we're looking at is the expectation value of the plaquette. This is the model that I'm considering. And we ran a VQE for different values of the coupling G. It took, there were many different tries before we got a plot this nice. You can see here we have the EDE solution, which we can get, right? Because in the end, this is a relatively small quantum system. You can see the result from the VQE experiment that it deviates a little bit. And then we were really interested in trying to understand what kind of errors were in these qubit systems. So we discussed with the experimentalists, and we came up with all in all pretty simple noise model. And you can see that this noise model, despite being pretty simple, actually sort of describes the kind of error that we are seeing. And the reason why we are interested in understanding this noise is also because this there are not so many works available on the realistic QDIT system. So it was pretty much, new territory for us. So we were really struggling to understand it better. So this is the first use case. And the second in the second use case, we were trying to answer, can we see experimentally the improvements when I refine the discretization? By refine the discretization, I mean I choose a better truncation, right? I use a larger D to model my gauge field. In order to highlight that, I consider a slightly different model. Here, now I'm still considering just four sites, but I close it with periodic boundary condition. So I hope you can see it. So these are my four sites, 1, 2, 3, 4. And they're on this torus because it's periodic boundary condition, so I'm closing all the edges. And I'm considering a pure gauge theory. So you have no fermionic matters on this site, right? You have only pure gauge. You only have gauge fields as degrees of freedom. If you count this, you will be able to see that in such a system, you have in principle 8 different gauge fields. And the first thing we try to do is always to simplify as much as possible, right? I still have the 3 independent Gauss law. And the 3 independent Gauss law will allow me to eliminate 3 gauge fields with 5 left. And then the details are also in this previous work on our group. What you do is that you make appropriate linear combinations of this gauge field, and you realize that out of these 5, if you're looking at the ground state, 2 of them actually have to be 0. So in the end, you're really left with these 3 gauge field type degrees of freedom, right? And these 3 gauge field degrees of freedom, I represent them here in this image. And you can see they're essentially just the 3 different plaquettes that I can have on this torus, right? And and everything else, every other dynamical quantity on this model can be expressed in terms of these 3 rotors. We call them rotors that we are left with. I'm doing good on time, yes. Okay. So now, because I am considered a pure gauge theory, right? I don't have the master term anymore. I don't have the kinetic term anymore. These are the only 2 terms that are left. And you can see that depending on the value of the coupling G, I can have certain regimes. So if G is very large, this is going to be negligible. So essentially, the ground state of my Hamiltonian is going to be close to the ground state of the electric term alone. And vice versa on the other side, right? And in this work, they use this idea to essentially formulate 2 different bases depending on which regime you're in. And the idea is simply that if, let's say, G is very large, then I better use an electric type basis, right? Where it's closer to the eigenstate of my electric Hamiltonian. And when G becomes small, then this basis is not, does not do a very good job of describing the system anymore, because it's not going to, the ground state is just not going to be 1 delta. It's going to be distributed among the various states, and the error is going to be larger. And then in the opposite regime, you formulate a new basis that is based on the magnetic term of the Hamiltonian. Each one of these bases is more efficient in different regimes. And on the opposite side, the truncation error is going to become more and more important. Just to show you an example, this is the variational circuit that we designed just for the electric representation. The circuit looks a little bit busy because I'm trying to represent both the because I am considering 2 different truncations. I'm considering the case, the Q-treat case and the Q-quint case, right? So the way to read it is that if I'm considering only a Q-treat system, you consider only the solid line, right? Only these 2 boxes, for example, and these 2 states don't exist. And I consider only this gray box. And if I'm considering a Q-quint system, then consider the other box and also all the dotted line. And again, this is also designed based on the form of the Hamiltonian, symmetries, interaction, same reasoning. There's an analogous magnetic variational circuit. And these are the results from a full experimental VQE. Let's see. What we are looking at is I'm using blue to show the magnetic representation, and orange warm colors for the electric representation. The lighter color corresponds to a Q-treat truncation. The darker color corresponds to a Q-quint representation. All with me? Yeah? OK. And then with the dotted line, I'm showing the associated exact diagonalization result. And you can see the truncation effect that I was talking about earlier, right? If I only look at the light colors, the exact case, you can see that in the electric representation, here the solid line, comes from exact diagonalization with an enormous D. So we were trying to get rid of truncation error and have something to compare it with, right? And you can see that if I'm considering a Q3 truncation, the electric basis does very well in the electric regime, but in the magnetic regime is quite far from what really happens, right? And for the magnetic basis is the opposite, right? It does very well in the magnetic regime, but is very far from the larger truncation. And you can also see that if I increase the truncation, so if I go from light to dark red, it gets closer to the real value, and the same on this side, right? So this is the kind of physics phenomena that I'm looking at. And now you can finally look at the markers. The markers come from experimental VQEs. So the four experimental VQEs were run, right? Two for the electric basis, two for the magnetic basis, with Q-treat and Q-quint each. And you can see that with the Q-treat system, so the lighter color, the experiment was actually pretty close to the exact diagonalization value. When you start going to larger truncations, it does become harder, right? You have more sources of noise. So you're a little bit further away, but it goes in the right direction. It has the correct general behavior that I want. And just to show you explicitly what this truncation effect that I was telling you about before, here for three different values of the coupling, we also measure the population in the two bases. So let's just look at the warm colors for now. The warm colors is the electric basis, right? And I have for different rows in this sense, I have different truncations. So this is 3 truncation, 5 truncation, 7 truncation. In gray, you have the exact diagonalization. Oh, and of course, what I'm plotting is the population of each one of this level. And you can see that in the electric regime, this is the delta that I was telling you before, right? In the electric regime, I'm essentially using already the correct basis. So only one state is occupied. But if I go into the opposite regime, then the other states become more important. And then that's where you really see the truncation effect, right? Because the more truncation, like the larger the truncation, you better you will approximate this curve. And you really start to see the truncation effect. And then it's the opposite for the magnetic field. And all the grays are exact diagonalization data. All the colors are experimental data. And they show exactly the feature, the behavior that I wanted. OK, so quick summary. What I showed you was a successful experimental variational quantum eigensolver performed with the mixed dimensional qubit system, Q-treats and Q-quints. All done with a calcium ions system. I hope I have convinced you that QDITs can really be a natural implementation of lattice gauge degrees of freedom. And I hope I showed you that I have certain, like, I have really nice properties. I have flexibility in realizing systems with mixed dimensions, and also in adjusting the truncation and studying and systematically evaluating truncation effects. And the outlooks. Of course, at the top, there is going to 3 spatial dimensions. There is quite a conceptual jump in going from 1 spatial dimension with no magnetic fields to 2. And there's a less of a jump going to 2 to 3. So now this is much closer to actual realization. We ran a variational quantum eigensolver, which just finds the ground state. And finding the ground state, actually, it's not sign problem afflicted. But with the same ingredients that we have developed for this work, we are very close to actually perform, for example, a real-time evolution. And that would be a sign problem afflicted problem. These are more long term. Actually, all of the quantum platforms that we look at, they are all naturally qubits, right? And people are now starting to look more with more attention to them and trying to realize these high fidelity entangling gates, which are the real challenge. But really, you have lots of different platforms that have potentially multi-level systems available, and each they will have their own like pros and cons. So I'm excited to explore that. And then also on the theory side, I have a feeling that the description of realistic qubits is sort of is a little bit left behind. So I'm really excited to explore more also in this direction. And I will just conclude with thanking the experimental collaborators that made this work possible. Michael Math is the PhD student who really did amazing thing and collected the data and ran the system, with Martin Ringbauer supporting and supervising him. They are within the larger group of Rainer Blatt at the University of Innsbruck. I want to thank the funding institutions that made this work possible. And of course, I want to thank you all for your attention.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions? There's a microphone over there, this one there, this one there, this one here. Yeah, Robert?
Yes.
Yeah. So my question is kind of inspired by the Martinez paper that you put there in your introduction, 2016 paper, for ions for trotter steps. So the limitation in that experiment was decoherence, not trap size. Mm-hmm. And confirming that, in a way, you gave a number, I think it was 234 entangling gates, 10% circuit fidelity remaining, whatever that means, and however that translates into measurement error for your energy. But I take from it, 234 entangling gates means mostly noise left. Okay, so now it's a bit unfair, my question, but I want to read you a sentence from an abstract.
Yes.
Also dealing.
Robert, can I bother you to hold the laptop and the microphone at the same time?
Sorry, I just totally forgot about the mic. Yeah, so it also concerned with the 1D Schwinger model.
Yeah.
It is from earlier this year. The title is Quantum Simulation of Hadron Dynamics in the Schwinger Model Using 112 Qubits.
Oh, yeah.
It's the first author, I don't know any of the authors, Roland Farrell, Martin Savage, and they say, one sentence here from the abstract, using multiple error mitigation strategies, up to 14 trotter steps of time evolution are performed, employing 13,000 and odd 2-qubit gates with a C-naught depth of 370.
Yes.
How can they have a signal remaining after these many gates and steps if you say you are in trouble after 234?
So I am in trouble after 234, but in both comparison, I'm not doing any kind of error mitigation, right? That's the key thing in that paper. They were able to have such deep circuits because they were using at least three different error mitigation methods at the same time. So yeah, for like currently noisy systems, error mitigation methods can really save you.
Okay, but I'm still surprised. I mean, if you say so, but I am told that error mitigation techniques are exponentially inefficient. They need exponentially many repetitions. That's presumably because, well, as your systems get large, you have lots of noise and you need to find your tiny signal in the noise. Yeah, and that's precisely my question. How can they still have a signal after so many gates? Mm-hmm. So that they can amplify it through repetition, mitigation. I'm really surprised.
I'd say that their work is a really nice sweet spot where their system is not large enough to make error mitigation completely useless, but it's also very large and pretty impressive. And it's really where error mitigation shows its usefulness. Okay. It's really like with this hundreds or something size system that it can really help. Also, I think there was a IBM. There was also an IBM paper that also had like order of hundreds CNOTS and hundreds size system, and they were also relying heavily on error mitigation methods. And there's a lot of exciting things happening in error mitigation for qubit system. And and right now we are at the point where like we can still do it with this size system. If it's not scalable, as you said, right, in the long term, but we are in this nice.
Okay, yeah. It surprises me tremendously.
I must say. We also had our own experience with that. We also did something much less ambitious with a much smaller system, but we could really see it. Without error mitigation, you run some kind of time evolution, and you see almost nothing but noise. And then if you use the error mitigation, you can extract the signal back. It's actually a little bit surprisingly nice, but yeah. It's really just a coincidence. So I feel like coincidence, maybe it's not the right word, but it's a combination of factors that
Thank you very much.
Other. Yeah, you're welcome.
Any further questions?
Yeah, and speaking of error mitigation, also error mitigation for qubit system is still someone has still to figure it out. So,
Good. I'd like to thank the speakers, all the speakers of today, and tonight we have the banquet at 6 p.m. Any further announcements? No. Okay. Please double check the schedule for tomorrow morning. We start a little bit later than today.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.